You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
This is WBCR LP 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. That was The Doors. And this is Mickey Friedman. And this is The Other Side. There are, of course, many sides and many truths. This show is about some of the other sides of the story. My pick of the many stories out there. Scott Ritter is a former Marine intelligence officer and was the chief inspector of the United Nations Special Commission to Disarm Iraq until he resigned in 1998. He spoke on Friday, June 3, 2005, at the Congregational Church in Salisbury, Connecticut.
Some would find it odd that a former Marine officer, somebody who continues to be a registered Republican and calls himself a conservative American, would be here tonight speaking to a venue of, I don't know you, but one would say that you might be able to characterize this audience as progressive, left-wing, if anything, maybe leaning moderate, but definitely not conservative Republican. But that's okay, because I think one of the things that we might all have in common is the fact that we call ourselves American citizens, and that we're proud to be Americans, and we love our country, and we can agree that our country is founded on certain principles and values that are set forth in one of the most wonderful documents that humankind has ever put forward, and that is the Constitution of the United States of America. It's a document that in 1984, in May of 1984, I raised my right hand and swore an oath to uphold and defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the oath I took when I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps. It's an oath I took seriously as a Marine. It's an oath I take seriously today as an American citizen. It's an oath that means that I was prepared to lay my life down for my country. And right now in Iraq, we have 140 plus thousand fellow Americans who have taken that same oath and who are laying their lives down. Tragically, too many of them have given their lives. Many thousands of others have given up parts of their body or their mental aptitude, because some of the casualties, most of the casualties that take place today come in the form of improvised explosive devices, anonymous explosions on the side of the road. War in Iraq is not so much closing with and destroying the enemy through firepower maneuver, the classic definition of combat that was pounded into my head in 12 years in the Marine Corps. War in Iraq today is more like Russian roulette, where our troops get on the highway and they roll down and they don't know when it's going to go boom, but more often than not it does go boom, and the injuries that result are horrific, not just bodies and limbs being torn off, but severe brain injuries because the concussion of a 155 millimeter round blowing up next to your vehicle is horrific. These men and women, brave men and women, honor us by wearing our uniform, wearing the uniform that I wore for 12 years, and I'm sure many of you in this audience have worn. You know, that uniform doesn't belong to the Congress of the United States. It doesn't belong to the President of the United States, even though he is Commander-in-Chief. That uniform is the uniform of the United States military. The flag that's sewn on the shoulder that these men and women wear is the flag of the United States of America. It all comes back to that oath that was taken to uphold and defend the Constitution. Read the Constitution. Far too few Americans have read it and understand it and live it and cherish it, and yet we have our fellow citizens out there dying for it. It starts off in the preamble, we the people of the United States of America. Those are important words, because those words set forth in that document mean that the Constitution isn't owned by the president. It's not the property of the Congress of the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States has established that because that preamble starts off with we the people of the United States of America, ownership of that document belongs to the people of America. It's our document. These men and women who have sworn to give their lives in defense of this document are our men and women. That military that they serve in is our military. And it's high time we start taking possession of our military, that we start to treat that military as if it's an extension of ourselves, our own being, as opposed to some entity out there that we really don't give a damn about. Far too many Americans say support the troops, but they haven't have a clue. They don't have a clue what that means, support the troops. You can stand on a corner and wave a flag all you want. That doesn't mean you're patriotic. That doesn't mean you're supporting the troops. I can train a monkey to wave the flag. I can't train a monkey to read and live the Constitution of the United States of America. The only way you can support the troops, truly support the troops, is to read that document, comprehend that document, and live that document so that when we send men and women off to fight and die in our name, when we ask them to make the ultimate sacrifice in defense of the Constitution, in defense of our country, that we ensure the sacrifice that we ask is worthy, or is the cause that we ask them to sacrifice is worthy of that sacrifice. And ladies and gentlemen, right now in Iraq, there is no cause worthy of the sacrifice of a single American life.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. A field day for the heat, 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
There might be a theme you might be hearing here tonight. It's about the Constitution, because that document sort of defines who we are and what we are as a people. It sets forth the ideals and the values. It defines America as a nation of law, the rule of law. And when you look at Iraq and the war that we're engaged in today in Iraq, a lot of people will say, hey, let's forget about how we got there. Let's not dwell on the past. We're there. We're in Iraq, and therefore, all good Americans must rally around the notion of, let's fix this issue. Let's stay the course. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you buy into that notion, that means that you accept the premise that the ends justify the means. It doesn't matter how we got there, but we're there. Hey, it's okay. We got rid of Saddam. It's a good deal, isn't it? Well, I'm sorry. We didn't go to war to get rid of Saddam. At least that wasn't the stated purpose for going to war in Iraq. We went to war in Iraq to get rid of weapons of mass destruction that the President of the United States said existed. He didn't say they might exist. He didn't say they may exist. He didn't say he thinks they exist. Go back and read the statements made by the President throughout the summer and fall of 2002, in the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. These were statements of certainty. These weapons exist. I know these weapons exist. The President said that he personally knows that Saddam Hussein maintains large stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons. The Vice President, Dick Cheney, went on TV and said he knows that Iraq has reconstituted its nuclear weapons program. Again, these aren't assessments. These are statements of fact being made by our elected representatives. And the reason we went to war, as stated by the President, as stated by the President's representatives before our representatives in the Congress of the United States of America, was to disarm Iraq, to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. We were told that Saddam Hussein wasn't going to get rid of his weapons, that he had these weapons, he wouldn't disarm, and therefore the only way we were going to get him disarmed was to send a coalition of the willing, to quote the President, to Iraq and disarm the madman, the dictator, Saddam Hussein. Now, I'm not going to sit here and debate the merits of any title you put on Saddam Hussein, madman, dictator, whatever you want to call him. It's irrelevant. Because you don't go to war to get rid of a madman. You don't go to war to get rid of a dictator. Or if you do go to war, you have to state that up front as your objective. And tell the Congress of the United States, tell the American people that we are going to shed American blood to get rid of a madman. And watch how far that floats. Because one of the problems with that is you have an issue, again, back to the Constitution. Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not, there's only two reasons that we, the people of the United States of America, legally empower our armed forces to go to war. I don't even want to mention that the vehicle for empowerment is the Congress of the United States that is solely empowered by the Constitution to declare war, and that this Congress did not declare war on Iraq. Let's put that aside. Two things. Article 6 says that when we, the people, the United States of America, enter into an agreement or a treaty that has been ratified by two-thirds of the United States Senate, that is the law of the land, the supreme law of the land. We're signatories to the United Nations Charter. Now, whether you like the United Nations or not, frankly speaking, is irrelevant. If you don't like it, put pressure on your congressman or woman or your senator to get the United States out of the United Nations, to walk away from our obligations. But until time, till that happens, we're bound by that document. That document says two reasons to go to war. One, if you've been invaded, legitimate self-defense, Article 51. Someone attacks America, we get to come back and defend ourselves. And I'm one of these guys that doesn't believe in defending is, you know, eye for an eye. You attack me, I'm killing you. I'm sorry. That's the Marine in me. I was trained to wage war, and if someone wants to wage war, we'll wage it. I hate war with every cell in my body. War is the most horrible thing that mankind can do to mankind. Because war is about one thing and one thing only, killing people. Forget all these notions of glory and, you know, honor and duty. That goes out the window the first time a bullet goes downrange. At that point in time, it's fear, survival, kill or be killed. That's what war is. We can wage war if someone attacks us. Or because we are a nation of law and the world is a community ruled by law as determined, as defined by the Charter of the United Nations, if the Security Council of the United Nations determines that a risk, a clear and present risk to international peace and security exists, and it passes a resolution under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter authorizing the use of military force, nations may engage in combat. We had such a resolution in 1991 when the United States led a coalition empowered by the rule of law to liberate the nation of Kuwait, which was invaded by Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Whether you agree with the war or disagree with the war in 1991, it was a lawful action. A lawful action. In March 2003, there is no such Security Council resolution authorizing the United States to lead a coalition of the willing into Iraq. This means that our actions in Iraq are unlawful. Not just from the standpoint of international law, ladies and gentlemen, but I want to bring it back to Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States of America. When we sat back and watched our army cross the border into Iraq, we were watching the commander-in-chief order American men and women to violate the Constitution of the United States of America. It's as simple as that. Black and white. It's not a debatable issue. The Constitution isn't something that we get up here and get to be free and free-willing with. We entered into an agreement. We violated the agreement. And it's not just international law. It's the document that defines who we are and what we are as a people. And the second we, the people, allow the president or Congress to play footloose and fancy-free with that document, we cease being Americans that are governed by that document. This is a very important issue. It's a fundamental issue that we're talking about. This isn't just about war in Iraq and whether you're, you know, pro-military or anti-military. This is about the basic fabric of American society. This is about the direction we're going in. And if, frankly speaking, we continue to move in this direction, 10 years from now, when my kids graduate from college, they may call themselves Americans. You may wave the American flag over your town hall, but this won't be the United States of America. It'll be something totally different. And frankly speaking, it may not be a country that I want to serve in the armed forces and die for. I'm willing to die for an America that is representative of the Constitution. I love that document. That's a document worth dying for. But the second we, the people of the United States of America, allow our elected representatives to walk away from that document without due process. Yes, you can amend the Constitution. There is due process to do that. The Constitution provides for that. Show me the amendment that says the president gets to throw away the Constitution and invade Iraq on a whim. There isn't one, ladies and gentlemen. And once you start parsing apart the Constitution, where do you stop? Did September 11th, 2001 really change America so fundamentally that we'll turn our back on that which defines who we are and what we are as a people? I think not. Are we really that afraid of terror that we're willing to give up that which defines us? I think not. And yet a lot of politicians act as though we, the people, have given them carte blanche, a blank check to do whatever they want, so long as it keeps us secure. Ladies and gentlemen, Iraq had nothing to do with keeping us secure. Now we come down to another basic issue. Why did we go to war with Iraq? Was it about getting rid of weapons of mass destruction? You can take apart my resume all you want. You can criticize me for this and for that and the other thing, but I'm telling you right now, you will not get another person to stand before you that knows more about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs than me. In 1991, I was recruited to go to the United Nations and form an intelligence unit that was singularly responsible for monitoring all data pertinent to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. Not just UN data. I was chief liaison with the CIA. You know, in 1998, Colin Powell made a wonderful statement that I was out of the intelligence loop, that I didn't know what was going on. At the same time that they were telling people that we had no new intelligence, that all the intelligence that the United States possessed dated back to the time of the weapons inspectors, which meant that the only data, therefore, that was relevant was the data I was responsible for, the data I got from the CIA, the data I got from Israel, the data I got from the British intelligence services, the French intelligence services, the German intelligence services, and the data I got leading 54 inspections into Iraq where we combed every square inch of that country looking for weapons of mass destruction. We interviewed every scientist of note several times. We carried out the most intrusive, forensically based inspections in the history of arms control. Now, one would say, well, then certainly you can tell us that 100% of the weapons were accounted for, if it were that easy. You see, this isn't an issue that can be simplified in terms of black and white. When we first went to Iraq in 1991, the onus, the responsibility for making disarmament a smooth process was clearly on the shoulders of the Iraqis. They were obligated to submit a declaration that listed the totality of the holdings of weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles, all components thereof, training, spare parts, manufacturing infrastructure, all had to be declared. Now, it would have been rather easy for the Iraqis to submit an honest declaration, and we could have verified it, and the program would have been over in 6 months. But the Iraqis lied. They submitted a false declaration. They denied having a biological weapons program. They denied having a nuclear weapons program. They underdeclared their missiles by 50%. They underdeclared their chemical weapons by 50%. Then the inspectors came into country. And we realized right from the very start that we weren't being told the truth. And we hunted the Iraqis, we hounded the Iraqis, and slowly, bit by bit, we uncovered their lies. Now, to give you an analogy that might work, think of it as a drug dealer out there, and he's got 10 bags of drugs. And I won't say what kind because I don't know too much about drugs, but you got 10 bags of drugs, call them marijuana. And he's dealing it, and the cops know. The cops are on him. They know he's dealing it. Finally, one day, cops come to the door, kick down the door, and the drug dealer flushes the 10 bags down the toilet. And the cops search and search and search and say, "Where are the drugs? We know you have the drugs." And the drug dealer said, "I don't have the drugs." This is what the Iraqis did. Their drugs were weapons of mass destruction. In the summer of 1991, as we started getting close to exposing their lies, the Iraqis destroyed everything without telling us. They just blew it up, took it out in the desert over the course of 3 or 4 days, blew it up and buried it. But we didn't accept that. We started finding data that proved. They said, "No, we never had these weapons," but we started getting data. We'd go to Germany. We'd dig up old records, procurement records. And we'd start to piece together data which proves the Iraqis were lying. Finally, the Iraqis realized that we're onto them and that the best thing they could do is just tell the truth. So in March 1992, they told the truth. They submitted a declaration and said, "We lied to you." We said, "Well, where are the weapons?" They said, "Well, come on into Iraq. We'll show them to you." So we flew in. We got on a bus. They took us out to the middle of nowhere. And there's nothing. I'm expecting 100 missiles lined up there so that I can count off 1, 2, 3 very easily. There's nothing. I said, "Where are the missiles?" So we blew them up and we buried them underground. So we had to become forensic archaeologists. We had to get a bulldozer out, dig the missiles up from the ground, and start counting them. Now, how do you count a blown-up missile? You don't. You have to count the, you have to gather the serial numbers off the different components of the missile. So we gather page after page after page of serial numbers. Then we go to Russia that built the missiles to the factory. We say, "Give us the logbooks of assembly." And we matched each serial number from each part to a specific missile. So that pretty soon we were able to reconstruct all the missiles. Then we got the shipping logs that showed which missiles were shipped to Iraq. And you know, we did a pretty good job. The Iraqis declared 98 missiles being destroyed. We could prove that 96 of them were there. We had a bunch of scrap metal over here that we thought were the other two missiles, but we couldn't prove it because we didn't have enough serial numbers. It didn't meet our standard of verification. Once the Iraqis lie to us, we don't give them the benefit of the doubt. Now we come back to the drug analogy. The cops, they don't believe that these guys flush 10 bags of drugs. So they go down through the sewer system, they go into the water treatment plant, and they produce 8 baggies, ripped up, but they got residue, and they can trace that residue all the way back to the toilet that flushed it. So the guy comes clean. Yep, I flushed the drugs. How many? 10 bags. Well, we can only show 8. We can only prove 8. What happened to the other 2? We can only prove 96 missiles. What happened to the other 2? Well, because the guy lied to us, because the Iraqis lied to us, we have to keep those 2 missiles on the books. The same thing with biological agent, the same thing with chemical agent, the same thing with the nuclear weapons program. We were able to reconstruct through our forensic investigations 90 to 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. In the nuclear field, it went up to 98%. But because we couldn't reconstruct 100%, there's still this unaccounted for material on the books. That unaccounted for material allowed the United States and other governments to say Iraq has not been certified as being fully disarmed. Now, we would come to the Iraqis and say, hey, you got to help us with these missing missiles, these missing chemicals. Where are they? The Iraqis said, well, they're blown up, man. We don't got them anymore. Creates an interesting problem. First of all, we start saying we need documentation. If you can't produce the body, give us documents. I say, what documents you want? You blew up the building that had the documents. They all burned. Well, how do you prove that? You can't. And it's further compounded by the fact that the Iraqis tried to hold on to a lot of their documents in secret from 92 to 95. I went around Iraq chasing down documents. And in the summer of 92, we actually surrounded a building that had the documents in them. We were held at gunpoint by the Iraqis, prevented from doing our job. Finally, when we go into Iraq as inspectors, you know, we don't carry guns. We don't have bulletproof vests or helmets. We got little blue passports and little blue armbands, really stylish. And we go up to a facility, knock on the door and say, we're weapons inspectors, open the door, we are allowed to come in and do whatever we want. Now, if the Iraqis open the door and let us come in and do whatever we want, things work great. But more often than not, the Iraqis would point a loaded weapon at us. And guess who wins that argument? Not the UN weapons inspector. So when the Iraqis would threaten us, we would have to back down and they would end up evacuating the documents, hiding them again. But we would never quit. We kept going back and back and back. And finally, the Iraqis, in 1995, turned over the documents. But here's the problem. We do an inventory of the documents, and what we know, what we've been able to forensically reconstruct, doesn't match the totality of the archive they've given us. There's gaps. The Iraqis say the gaps come from the fact that this document was in this building, got blown up and burned. But how do we know they're not lying to us? How do we know they haven't stuffed that document in the back of a truck and they're hiding it around someplace? Big problem. Here's another problem. We're trying to figure out what happened to the Iraqi biological weapons program. So a bunch of us smart guys like me get around a table and go, if I were an Iraqi, how would I hide a biological program? And we've gone to every facility in Iraq. And it's not just going to facilities, ladies and gentlemen. We didn't just inspect. We monitored every industrial facility in Iraq. Think about that. Every industrial facility in Iraq, we went to. We put cameras in. We put sensors in. We took soil samples. We took paint samples. We found no evidence of retained weapons of mass destruction. So now the question is, if the Iraqis are hiding it, how are they hiding it? So we came up with a brilliant concept, mobile biological weapons labs. You might have heard that before. Mobile biological weapons labs. We didn't have any evidence that they existed. We made them up. We just said, if the Iraqis are hiding them, the only way they can hide them is by putting them on trucks and moving the trucks around the country. So now we do inspections to find the trucks. The problem is, once you do an inspection to find a truck that you don't know exists, you sort of certify that a truck might exist. So what happens if you do an inspection, it's a very good inspection, and you find no trucks? No mobile biological weapons laboratories. A, they never existed. Or B, the Iraqis are really good at hiding them. Well, everybody chooses B. So you create this myth now of the missing biological weapons, the trucks that are moving around. Compounding this, remember, let's back up one more time. Sorry to confuse it, but we got to bring this up. Remember I talked about that Security Council resolution that was passed to disarm Iraq? The Security Council voted for it. Weapons inspectors were sent in. What if I told you that the country that wrote that resolution, that pushed it in the Security Council, had no intention of disarming Iraq, had no interest in disarming Iraq? That disarm of Iraq was always a red herring, a facade, for another purpose. What if I told you that the United States of America, in March 1991, the resolution was passed in April 1991, that the United States of America had already embarked on a policy of regime change in Iraq? If you go back and study the statements made by President George Herbert Walker Bush in the lead up to the first Gulf War, think of the terminology that he uses. Saddam Hussein is the personification of evil. Saddam Hussein is the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. Now that language, ladies and gentlemen, is very powerful. Because once you call Saddam Hussein Adolf Hitler, you have just negated any possibility of a diplomatic resolution. In fact, the president went further on saying Saddam Hussein and his government must be subjected to a Nuremberg-like retribution. That meant that we're talking World War II. We're talking about bringing the government, putting on trial. That's what the president promised in going to war with Iraq. Now, the United Nations only authorized the liberation of Kuwait. And that's what we did. And we came home. We had those big victory parades. But while the troops are parading in New York City and Washington, D.C., President George Herbert Walker Bush has a political problem. Because he promised the American people Saddam Hussein's head on a platter. And while they're watching the troops parade down Times Square victoriously, Saddam's still in place in Baghdad. The president has a political problem, not a national security problem. Understand there's a big difference. Saddam Hussein was defeated. His army was destroyed. His nation was in devastation. But President George Herbert Walker Bush had a political problem because Saddam Hussein's still in Baghdad. In March 1991, the CIA publishes an intelligence estimate that says Saddam Hussein has 6 months to live. The combined effects of economic sanctions, military defeat, etc., mean that if we can just squeeze him, somebody's going to give us the 75-cent solution. That's the cost of one 9mm bullet that we're hoping the general would put in Saddam's head and eliminate our Saddam Hussein problem. Problem with sanctions. We put sanctions. Sanctions are strangling Iraq's economy, weakening Saddam Hussein politically. But sanctions were imposed in August 1990 when Saddam invaded Kuwait. They were linked to the Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. Well, now, March 1991, Iraq's out of Kuwait. We kicked them out. Kuwait's liberated. There is no legal justification for the continuation of economic sanctions. So how do you squeeze Saddam for 6 months? You got to come up with a new justification for sanctions. That new justification was weapons of mass destruction. Now, we built a mountain out of a molehill on that one, ladies and gentlemen, about the only category that we had a legitimate right to be concerned about was the nuclear weapons category. But we talked about chemical weapons because he used them against his own people, because he used them against the Iranians. Ladies and gentlemen, a Marine Corps rifle company with an unlimited supply of ammunition will kill more people than Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons. They're not weapons of mass destruction. Iraq's biological weapons were so bad. You know, America's experienced a biological attack. We saw it in October 2001 with the letters, with the anthrax letters. Remember how they work? They go through the machine, puts the dust up in the air, small microns, 0.03, 0.05, you breathe them in, you get in your lungs, you die, unless you get the antibiotics. In order for it to be lethal, you got to breathe it in. It's got to get through your system, into your lungs. It's got to be very small. It's got to be a dry powder, or it's got to be an aerosol. Iraq produced liquid bulk anthrax. Sort of envision diesel oil. They couldn't turn it into dry powder. They couldn't aerosolize it. And it wasn't very good to begin with. But they put it on weapons for psychological effect, for political effect. The only way an Iraqi biological weapon was going to kill you is if it landed on your head. Because if it missed you and hit the ground next to you and cracked open, it was just going to seep into the earth. But no, we now said that Iraq possesses weapons that makes it a clear and present threat to international peace and security. This is an Iraq that was just devastated on a battlefield. It has no army left. This is an Iraq that has been bombed into submission. This is an Iraq that has economic sanctions strangling its lifeblood. And we get the Security Council to pass a Chapter 7 resolution that says Iraq is a clear and present threat to international peace and security so long as it has any weapons of mass destruction. And there's the problem. Because now we come back to my accounting. I'm a weapons inspector. I can account for 99.5% of it. But the law says 100%. And so long as I can't guarantee that 100% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction have been accounted for, you can't lift sanctions. That's okay, because sanctions weren't supposed to last forever, just 6 months. Then Saddam would go away. Clock started to tick, and Saddam didn't go away. In fact, Saddam got stronger and stronger and stronger. Those sanctions we imposed allowed him to deflect the wrath of the Iraqi people away from him, back on the United States and the Security Council. As women and children and old people started dying because of sanctions, the Iraqi people didn't blame Saddam. They blamed the United States. They blamed the United Nations. Where the blame rested? Ladies and gentlemen, we disarmed Iraq by 1996. By 1996, we could stand before anybody and guarantee that we could account for 90 to 95% of their weaponry, and the 5 to 10% that we cannot account for has no relevance, none whatsoever, because we monitor every industrial facility in Iraq. Chemical weapons that we're concerned about that we can't account for have a shelf life that measures in hours, days, weeks. Biological agents stored under ideal circumstances in post Gulf War Iraq, nothing was ideal, had a shelf life of 3 to 5 years. The last known biological agent was produced in January 1991. Then the factory went bye-bye. Now, I'm just a Marine. I'm no rocket scientist, but even I can do the math on that one. 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96. If the Iraqis were hiding biological agent, it's no longer useful. It's deteriorated into gunk. The same with chemical agent. By 96, we could confirm the qualitative disarmament of Iraq. But because the American policy wasn't disarmament, it didn't matter. The American government insisted on the quantitative disarmament of Iraq, accounting for every nut, bolt, and screw, 100%. And they had the law on their side. Security Council resolution calling for 100% disarmament, or else sanctions stay in place. Why do we want sanctions to stay in place? Because sanctions allow Saddam Hussein to be contained until which time the United States can achieve the means to remove him from power. October 1992, George Herbert Walker Bush signs a lethal finding, a covert finding, authorizing the CIA to use whatever means necessary, up to and including lethal force, to remove Saddam Hussein from power. That is the policy of the United States. Over and over again, the president and his Secretary of State, James Baker, made presentations to the Congress and before the American public where they said economic sanctions will not be lifted against Iraq even if Saddam complies with its obligation to disarm, until which time he is removed from power. That's a violation of international law right there, because the Security Council resolution makes no reference to regime change. It speaks of getting rid of weapons of mass destruction, not getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Since 1992, the policy of the United States has been regime change. When Bill Clinton got elected in 93, he continued this policy. He continued the CIA's covert finding. The problem is the covert finding that was initially passed was weak. Bill Clinton inherited a political problem, one that the Republicans started using to beat him up on. Hey, Billy boy, what you doing about that bad guy Saddam? Clinton didn't help himself when he got elected. He said, I'm a good Southern Christian boy. I believe in deathbed conversions. I think we can do business with Saddam. We can get him to recant and bring him back into the family of nations. And immediately, everybody, Republicans and Democrats alike, jumped on him and said, you can't do business with Saddam. Why? Because he poses a threat to the national security of the United States? No. Because he poses a threat to their electability. When a congressman signs up to confront evil, the personification of evil, I remind you, the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler, when he stands before his constituents and says, I'm confronting Saddam Hussein, and he runs on that platform, how can he not do business with Saddam? You open yourself up. Maybe your legs cut out from under you. You're going to not be reelected. So we continue to confront Saddam Hussein, not because he's a threat, but because he's a political problem. The only way these guys can resolve their political problem is to get rid of Saddam. George W. Bush gets elected. Maybe you guys didn't read the Republican platform. I did. Cornerstone. Remove Saddam Hussein from power. Called George many things, but, you know, saying that he lied about what he wanted to do with Iraq is not one of them. Right up front, from day one, he didn't publish it on the front page of the New York Times because the New York Times didn't pay attention. But it was right there in the platform, regime change. It predates George W. Bush. United States Congress in November 1998 passed a law, the Iraq Liberation Act, which became public law of the United States, that talked about removing Saddam Hussein from power, giving up $100 million to the Iraqi opposition. It's an interesting law because it's an American law that violates international law and the Constitution at the same time. But no one did anything about it. Then September 11th comes. Horrible day. And President Bush, who had this desire to get rid of Saddam Hussein, now had the enabling device, the global war on terror. All he had to do was tell the American people that Saddam Hussein was linked to those who attacked us. And with all due respect to you and the audience, I don't include you in this. Maybe I should, but I won't. But, you know, for a technologically advanced nation, perhaps the most technologically advanced nation on the face of the earth, America's populated by the single most ignorant group of people. We know nothing about the world we live in. And from this ignorance, fear is born. So when something horrible like September 11th occurs, you know, one of the worst things you could have done after September 11th is raise your hand and say, hey, why'd they attack us? It's an important question. You know, you can't solve a problem until you define the problem. It's an age-old tenet. I learned it as a second lieutenant coming in as an intelligence officer. And I'm out there going, solution, solution, solution. My boss is going, whoa, young buck, what's the problem? I don't know, but I got the solution. No, you don't. Define the problem and then come to me with the solution. September 11th comes. September 12th, President Bush calls a war cabinet where they are already talking about invading Iraq and getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And amazingly, stories start coming out about weapons of mass destruction, about the links with Al-Qaeda, about Saddam Hussein's cozy relationship with Osama bin Laden. No evidence was put forward to back this up. Just statements and some murky defectors that miraculously appeared, not to the CIA, but to Judith Miller in the New York Times. And we bought it. We, the people of the United States of America, bought it. We said, yeah, makes sense. He's a personification of evil. He's the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. Sure he's in bed with Osama. You know, they politics makes strange bedfellows. That was another one out there to justify every, you know, anybody with a shred of common sense would sit there and go, Saddam Hussein, secular dictator, who has declared war on Islamic fundamentalism, especially Wahhabism, Osama bin Laden, Islamic fundamentalist personified, Wahhabist. Saddam has declared war against Osama. Osama's put out a fatwa saying it's okay to kill Saddam. And suddenly they're close personal friends? Doesn't make any sense. But the politicians said it. Nobody had the courage after 9/11 to stand up and confront him on it. And it flew. It was accepted. It was one of those things that just got accepted by the American people, by the American media. How many so-called, you know, Dan Rathers and Tom Brokaws and others got up there every night, and the American people, the voice you can trust, Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein are allied against the United States. And all Americans go, yeah, that's good. I buy that. No evidence. No facts. Just a statement made over and over and over again. Bring to life what Joseph Goebbels said back in the days of the real evil, Adolf Hitler. If you say a lie loud enough and often enough, it gets accepted as the truth. Ladies and gentlemen, in Iraq, we had a couple lies thrown out there. One, that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were in cahoots. And two, that Saddam Hussein had massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. Again, there's no evidence to back this up. Today, we talk about the intelligence mistake. Oops. Sorry. Don't blame the president. He was just told things by the CIA. There's three studies that are out there right now. The Iraq Survey Group, the CIA's team that went in after we invaded Iraq to do their own study, they've come out and said all weapons of mass destruction were destroyed by the summer of 1991, that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The Senate Select Intelligence Committee report says the same thing. And even the president's own hand-picked special commission on WMD says the same thing. We got it wrong, dead wrong, to quote the report. But see, that's so convenient. We got it wrong. Aren't we all human after all? Can't we all make mistakes? Of course we can. Shame on the CIA. We'll appoint John Negroponte as intelligence czar, and it will all be okay. And now we can trust the president when he says Iran has a nuclear weapons program. It doesn't work that way, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, there was no intelligence failure. I'm standing before you as a man who served as the intelligence liaison with the CIA from 1991 to 1998. In 1992, I briefed the CIA on the fact that we could account for all but two of Iraq's ballistic missiles. And we think we know what happened to the other two. The CIA came back and said, no, there's 200. It was physically impossible for there to be 200 missiles in Iraq. You don't just give birth to missiles. They have to be produced someplace. And there's no way Iraq could have 200. But we did another year's worth of investigations looking for buried missiles. We took ground-penetrating radar, put it on helicopters, flew all over Iraq, dove in the rivers looking for buried missiles in the rivers. People talked about giant hidden caverns under Baghdad. You know, again, I'm not a smart guy, but I bring smart guys in with me. And I brought in this geophysicist, and we're walking around Baghdad, and I'm talking about the buried facilities. You know, Scott, before you have a buried facility to hunt, we should be looking for the giant pumps. So what do you mean pumps? We're looking for things underground, man. They're burying them underground. The boy, get a shovel. Gave me a shovel, took me out into a yard, started digging. Got down about 3 feet, water started seeping in. Baghdad's an alluvial plain between two big rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates. There's water underneath the ground. You dig that big hole and put that big factory in, you know what you got? You got buoyancy. This big old air pocket, you're sticking down this giant mass of water, it's just going to pop it straight up. We'd find the factories, because they'd just be popping up all over the place like carrots. Unless you have giant water pumps that are evacuating the water. Those create heat, We flew over Iraq with heat-seeking cameras, didn't find any. They require electricity to wear. Didn't exist. So I came back and I briefed the director of the CIA in November 1993. Sir, all missiles have been accounted for. Detailed briefing with all of his representatives there. They walked away, came back and said, 12 to 20, and that's the number we're sticking with. We're never going to change it. Facts didn't matter, ladies and gentlemen, except this fact. The United States had a policy of regime change to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Key to this was containing Saddam through economic sanctions that could only be sustained if you maintain the perception that Saddam Hussein was not cooperating, that Saddam Hussein had not disarmed. If we could shut the file on ballistic missiles, as we had done, we accept the notion of the possibility Iraq might be disarmed. Then we could shut the other files. They can't allow a single file to be closed. That number 12 to 20. Go read the CIA's assessments leading up to March 2003. 12 to 20, same number, never changed. It's the one honest thing the director of the CIA said. That's our number, and we're sticking to it. So when we talk about a mistake, there was no mistake made. This was not an accident. This was done on purpose. This was about regime change. And now we come to my conclusion. This is the one that might irritate some of you, but it's one I want you all to reflect on. We're Americans. We the people of the United States. As Abraham Lincoln said on the Gettysburg Battlefield, government of the people, by the people, for the people. It's our country. This country works if we function as a democratic republic. This function works. This country works if we function as citizens who complete the cycle, the electoral cycle. It's not just about going into a booth and pulling a lever. Adolf Hitler was elected. Every Russian, the Soviet dictator was elected. Saddam Hussein was elected. So going into a booth and pulling a lever does not make you democratic. The democratic process only works if you hold those whom you elect to represent you accountable for what they do in your name. It's an ugly process, this thing we call American democracy, but it works if we the people are engaged. We have to hold our elected officials accountable. This isn't about political differences. You, as I said, you might have been anti-war and said that the first Gulf War, the one fought in 91, you were against it. But you know what? You're in the minority, so therefore, as long as the president doesn't violate the law, you can express your opinion, but the majority wins, and we move forward as long as we operate within that framework of law. What happens, though, when our elected officials tell a lie? Richard Nixon told a lie about Watergate. It's a too big cover-up. A bunch of thugs kicking down the door of a Democratic National Convention, stealing some documents. A threat to our national security. But he lied. He covered it up. He's gone. Bill Clinton has a little dalliance in the back office. Who cares? But he lied. So they impeached him. If you're going to impeach Bill Clinton for lying about having a sexual liaison with an intern, what are you going to do with a president who stands before the American public, before the Congress of the United States? When a government official tells a lie in the course of his or her official duties, that is fraud, ladies and gentlemen. That is a felony. That is the classic definition of a high crime and misdemeanor. That is language specific to the Constitution about impeachment. On October 16th, 2002, the President of the United States stood before the American people in the Congress with a resolution that Congress had passed giving him war powers. He said, although this resolution gives me war powers, I have not yet decided to wage war against Iraq. He lied, and it's documented, ladies and gentlemen. It's documented. It's documented in a number of areas. One, the United States Army released a secret report in the aftermath of the Gulf War in which the Army says the president signed the execute order on August 28, 2002. August 28th. But even prior to that, we now have a document come out of England that shows that the president had made a decision to remove Saddam Hussein using military force. In fact, Tommy Franks, when he's briefing the president in July 2002 is not talking about theoretics. He's talking about the practical application of a military plan, starting to move troops, move munitions, move capabilities forward. The president signed an order authorizing this to take place, but it's not just the movement of troops, ladies and gentlemen. It's what was said in that memo. The policy was regime change, and we will fix intelligence around the policy. It means intelligence is no longer about facts. It's no longer about truth. Intelligence becomes a commodity that will be manipulated by the president to achieve a political end. The political end was regime change. The president lied. He lied. His representatives lied. Colin Powell went before the United States Senate and testified that the president has not yet made a decision to wage war in Iraq, October, November 2002. Condoleezza Rice did the same thing. Donald Rumsfeld did the same thing, but they were all in on the decision-making. They knew the president had already signed the execute order. In September 2002, we started launching the first phase of the Gulf War. The 100-plane attack on western Iraq, destroying Iraq's air defense systems, has nothing to do with enforcement of the no-fly zone. A lot of these strikes took place outside of the no-fly zone. It was about opening up corridors so American special forces could enter into Iraq. I won't give you the exact date. I know it, but I don't want to be accused of giving away classified information. Let's just say that the American forces were operating in Iraq well in advance of the March 19th. 2003 official crossing of the border. The war started in September. The war started in September, and October 16th, the president said, I have not made a decision to go to war. Ladies and gentlemen, the president lied. The president committed fraud in the course of his official duty. The president should be investigated for a felony charge, and if found guilty, the president should be impeached because the president has violated the trust and confidence of the American people. A Republican. This isn't about being a Democrat. This is about being an American. And frankly speaking, not one of us are worth a damn if we let this president get away with this. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions.
For more information about the preparations for war, check out www.afterdowningstreet.org. That's www.afterdowningstreet.org. To hear more programs like this, go to the Action section of iraqproject.org. That's www.iraqproject.org. We heard For What It's Worth, the Buffalo Springfield, A Foggy Day in Vietnam, Led Zeppelin, and 4th of July, U2. This is WBCR-LP, 97.7 FM, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Mickey Friedman, and this is The Other Side.